This is the Protestant Libertarian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute and part of the Christians for Liberty Network. I really hope that you guys enjoy today's show. All right, guys, welcome to another episode of the Protestant Libertarian Podcast. Returning to the show today are Cody Cook and Doug Stewart. Cody is an author and the host of the podcast Cantus Firmus, and Doug is the CEO of the Libertarian Christian Institute, as well as the host of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. We are going to be talking on the show today about the rise of progressive Christianity and its social, political, and theological consequences. We are also going to explore the very real structural similarities of progressive Christianity and Christian nationalism. Gentlemen, welcome back to the Protestant Libertarian Podcast.
Hey, I was going to let Doug say hi first because he's the CEO of the Libertarian Christian Institute, but he didn't.
And I was going to exercise, you know, servant leadership and let you go first.
Man, you guys are so great. I love this. Well, hey, I mean, everyone knows who you guys are, and I'm going to give you guys a chance to plug all of your work at the end of the episode, but I figure we're just going to jump right into this. So a couple of months ago for the Libertarian Christian Institute, I wrote an article called Progressive Christian Nationalism, and in it I argued that politically the structure of progressive Christianity and the structure of Christian nationalism are almost identical because they want to impose certain laws upon all of society that are reflective of their Christian values, and they want to do so for the good of everyone in society. And so there's a lot of overlap between those two concepts. And so I wanted to go even broader than that and kind of just talk about the phenomenon of progressive Christianity. I knew that you two were like the right people to have on this show to discuss this. For some of my listeners, progressive Christianity might be a brand new concept. So I wanted to give you guys both the opportunity to kind of define it. So what is, from your perspective, progressive Christianity? What does that term mean to you? And maybe, Doug, I know we were texting a little bit before the show, the three of us were, and you had some nuances for the definition. So Doug, I figured I'd open this one up to you first.
Yeah. Well, you know, as I was becoming less of a conservative Christian after Bible college, and this would have been like the mid-aughts at this point, I was, you know, enamored with some things out of the sort of what we'd call liberal or left-leaning theological realm. And I came in contact with this idea of progressive Christianity, and I met a handful of individuals that would call themselves that, and there were a lot of different variations of it, and so it would be difficult to pin it down. You know, you could probably have a self-professed progressive Christian on in the future, Alex, and if he listens to this episode, he might be like, yeah, Doug and Cody, they kind of got it wrong, or they didn't get it complete or whatever. So, you know, the definitions are gonna be shifting and depending on, you know, who it is. But when I did a quick Google search to be like, okay, how do you define this? And there's a handful of things that are like really getting top hits. And some of them are more from the people who are sort of describing it in definitely negative terms, like rewriting of essential elements of biblical teaching to fit Western secular values, focusing on the human work of Christ, uses theology to be activist, typically social justice oriented. And I finally found like somebody on Medium, we can link to it for your show notes, who has basically sort of described it as a self-described gay Christian who went to a church with two lesbian pastors. Okay, so like probably a legit guy who's progressive, right, in that regard. And so he spelled out three main things. Christianity is a lifestyle, not a system of beliefs, and not a set system of beliefs, I should clarify. Social justice is inseparable from Christianity. And number three, there is no one true faith. Okay, so this is one guy's sort of, you know, three-part take on it. And, you know, the concept of progressive Christianity is definitely going to sound more left-leaning or liberal. And we can talk about liberal and progressive here in a minute. And so you know, the theology is going to come out from that. And so in terms of like its popularity and attraction by what would be typical evangelicals, that kind of happened in the late 90s with the emergent church movement. The progressives were not vilified the way they typically were historically. And I think a lot of people who are typically conservative evangelicals were enamored by certain writers who had really great things to say about the scriptures, maybe not necessarily the best conclusions to draw, but they were willing to ask questions that these people weren't allowed to ask. And so progressive Christianity is very much a de-supernaturalizing, if you will, of what's going on in the scriptures. So that's kind of my overall. I don't know, Cody, if you have anything to add that I may have missed or some backstory that might be helpful for listeners, you might want to fill some of those gaps in. And then we can maybe after that talk about progressive versus liberal, because those terms overlap in different ways in this conversation.
Yeah, I guess. So first of all, I think we're going to be going back and forth a little bit based on some of the notes that you'd sent us ahead of time, Alex, that we're going to talk a little bit about politically progressive Christianity and also theologically progressive Christianity.
Yeah.
And I would almost be inclined to maybe to use the word liberal for theologically progressive Christianity and maybe progressive for the political version. It's as far as like what those two words mean, they are similar in the sense that to be liberal means to be free. It has that word liber, which also libertarian comes out of. And progressive has to do with sort of looking forward. And ultimately, both of those mean that you're freeing yourself of traditional shackles or restrictions. But the problem with that is that sometimes an idea is not a bad one just because it's old. Sometimes it's actually helpful to hold on to something old. In fact, the fact that it's old could be used as an argument in its favor. It's managed to stick around, so perhaps it's useful. The way politically we think about it is conservatism is an orientation toward time, that the things that we've developed in the past are good and we should try to hold on to them. And if we are going to get rid of them, we should do it slowly and carefully. And progressivism says, okay, we need to jettison all that stuff and move forward. That all that old stuff is bad. And so when you think of it in those terms, there is a kind of a parallel track. When you're thinking about politically progressive Christianity and theologically progressive Christianity, it's an orientation toward the future and away from the past. That being said, I guess we probably want to start with the theologically progressive version. And so I'll cite historical theologian Claude Welch's definition of liberal Christianity, where he defines it as, quote, maximal acknowledgement of the claims of modernity in Christian thinking about doctrines, end quote. So modernity, according to Roger Olson's pretty helpful book, Against Liberal Theology, is defined by, quote, a secular or at least not supernatural spirit, end quote. He writes that the liberals tend to reinterpret scripture, doctrine, thought, and religious experience in terms of modernity, giving modern thought authority alongside, if not over, scripture and tradition. Liberal theology tends to interpret the Bible and our Christian faith non-supernaturally and rationalistically. Since doctrines like the Trinity and the deity of Christ, the virgin birth, the bodily resurrection, all these require miracles or at least some kind of a conflict maybe with rationalistic naturalism, or at least a tension, we'll say. Liberals tend to not believe in these doctrines, or they'll claim to affirm them maybe in a non-literal sense. As an example of liberal modernistic thinking, it's popular to cite the New Testament theologian Rudolf Bultmann, who said something like, the modern person cannot use electric lights and also believe in the virgin birth. And
I love Bultmann, man.
And he may have not meant
that. I've never heard that one before.
You will hear that one sometimes. And I don't know that he meant that exactly the way it sounds, but you know, I think it nevertheless serves as kind of a useful symbol of sort of the hubris of the modernistic mindset, right? Liberalism doesn't just reject supernaturalism, though. It also tends to soften features of Christian doctrine that it views as too harsh. Another quote that comes to mind is from H. Richard Niebuhr, who was at one point a theological liberal and went a little bit to the right. And he defined theological liberalism as, quote, a God without wrath brought men without sin into a kingdom without judgment through the ministrations of a Christ without a cross, end quote. I'm almost at the end of these definitions. So liberalism also tends to challenge the uniqueness of Christ, sanding off his rough edges until he sounds like just another wise man. It's, you know, Buddha, Confucius, they're all kind of one and the same. J. Gresham Machen, who also wrote a book on liberal Christianity, referred to this liberal idea that all religions are basically the same once you remove the particularities. And he described it as a brotherhood of beneficent vagueness. You know, it's nice, it's good, but there's nothing really specific. They're all, you know, if we kind of take everything that makes them unique, they're all kind of the same. It's like, well, I guess that's true in one way. One thing I will say, though, as we're kind of, we've moved out of a modern.
Literally the definition of sameness, though, is to take away everything that's unique.
There you go. So the one thing I will say, though, so I talked a lot about modernism and rationalism, and as we've sort of moved out of modernism and into postmodernism, some of these modernistic emphases have shifted, I think. But ultimately, that's kind of the background definition, and I think it's a helpful starting point. Really quickly, the difference between liberal Christianity and historic Christianity is basically that the latter takes a high view of Scripture and seeks to hold to what Scripture affirms, even its supernatural worldview. In contemporary America, where we have light bulbs, even many theologically conservative Christians tend to feel very uncomfortable with certain supernatural claims of the Bible, the angels, demons, Nephilim, all that stuff. And I think that's largely the result of modernism's influence upon the church. We don't really trust supernatural claims like people before us did. And that is my very long-winded definition, which I hope is helpful.
Hey, that's a really good foundation. Doug, I know that you kind of mentioned the liberal progressive thing before. Do you want to add anything to that before we move on?
Well, because this is the Protestant Libertarian podcast and we're all libertarians and maybe leaning anarchist or are anarchist, however we want to say it, at least, you know, some of us in this little table here, we can jump back and forth in this conversation to talk about political and theological topics. And the trick with that is the word progressive is actually a fine word to use for both sides, but liberal is not on either side. And I absolutely refuse to give what is the modern progressive movement the self-label of liberal. I don't like it when I understand when I understand when the right wing's like, oh, you're just a liberal, and they mean people like, you know, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, you know, Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, all that, right? And I understand what they mean, but I'm like, no, they're not liberals, okay? They are progressives. That is the better definition of them. And not because they're looking forward and we're not. I don't mean it that way, but because they do not believe in freedom. They do not believe in being freed from that which can oppress. They are very illiberal as a movement. And there's plenty of documentation to show this. There's plenty of books been written about it. I just absolutely refuse to let them have it. It's too bad that it can't be redeemed by the libertarians, because we might actually attract a number of people, but you know, we don't get to determine what words actually mean. But we can refuse to use them to describe people. I'll put it this way. I will not use their, I don't know, if political labels were a pronoun, I'm not going to let them use that pronoun.
Yeah, I think it's a really good way to put it. And that's definitely going to help us frame the conversation, especially when we get into comparing progressive Christianity to Christian nationalism. Now, I graduated from Bible college in 2012, and I knew that there were some people at my school that had like kind of leftward leanings, but it was nothing like what we see the progressive Christian movement embracing today. And it seems to have like just exploded in terms of size over the last couple of years. So I want to put these two questions to you guys to get your thoughts on them. So number one, when did we start to really see this phenomenon emerge? I know that Doug has said that, you know, it's kind of got roots going back to the emergent church, you know, the early 2000s and the late 90s, but the more recent phenomenon of widespread progressive Christianity, when did that emerge? And then what are some of the social and political factors that led to the beginning of this movement?
Well, I could take a stab at it by talking a little bit about the emergent church and then sort of, you know, leapfrogging in back in history a little bit. At least this is where it caught my attention. And honestly, you know, the people who were so the emergent church movement basically was a sort of, it was deconstruction before, and I know we're going to talk about that term later, I think. It was deconstruction in a more, I don't know, acceptable way, as opposed to just like, you know, trying to dismantle literally everything the way things are going right now. So it was deconstruction before deconstruction was cool, right? And it was in the late 80s, early 90s. It was very much after a lot of Christian theologians and pastors were tapping into this concept of postmodernism and understanding what it means. And the idea was basically, hey, we feel like we can question certain things. And they were asking honest questions about what the scripture teaches, what is being taught from the scriptures, I should say, and whether or not some of those assumptions about how the scriptures were communicating. And so they kind of went in a different direction, various directions, I should say. And so there's actually, you know, I mean, we're a good 25, 30 years away from the sort of origins of that. But there were a lot of really, really good pastors asking really good questions and giving space for people who didn't trust, quote unquote, the powers that be. They didn't trust them, whether it was, you know, out of all kinds of different reasons. So there was a space, and the internet was, you know, definitely coming of age, and forums and podcasts were really in your infancy later on in the early aughts. And so there was a lot of space for people to question beliefs. And then we see the emergence of a lot more self-publishing. And so there's a lot of people who have really good things to say, really good questions, and maybe even bad conclusions, maybe even good conclusions. And now we're seeing the now, I would say, young 20s people start to latch onto that. And when you have a theological movement not grounded in certain moral, I don't want to call them moral absolutes, but that would be one way of putting it. You have a lot of people just kind of choosing their own path. And the concepts that I think the three of us kind of grew up in with respect to, you know, we appreciate the factors of community, the benefits of community to understanding what tradition is, why do we have it, and things like that. So I think in terms of the emergent church kind of evolving into something a little bit more destructive nowadays. And I don't even think we could call this the emergent church movement anymore, but they did have an influence on it with respect to how evangelicals became more progressive in their theological leanings. And part of that had to do with this concept of a social gospel. And that was a really big term when I was in seminary. Alex, Cody, you probably talked about this a lot when you guys are in, you know, getting master's degrees. And the original social gospel movement was at the turn of the 20th century with Walter Rauschenbusch. And he just felt that, you know, he basically directly challenged the idea that the individual is the sole recipient of the message of the gospel, and that the social justice movement was a gospel, it's grounded in a proper understanding of the gospel. You know, number two of that definition that I mentioned above, social justice is inseparable from Christianity. I would actually agree with that statement with certain provisions in a certain way, but the concept of a social gospel was sort of recaptured by the progressive Christian movement in the last 20 or 30 years, and it became very important to live out one's faith with a very direct and overt experience, and maybe even activism, sometimes even encouraged activism in the political space, the public square, so to speak. And so, you know, you have your people like Jim Wallis, who founded certain, I don't know if he still leads Sojourners. You know, he has this phrase, Christianity or faith is always personal, but never private. You know, and that's kind of true on the one sense, but on the other hand, that's sort of his ticket to saying, I can tell you what to do with your life. and I can legislate for it. So anyway, I've rambled enough. I think Cody, you probably have plenty to jump in on with that.
Yeah, I've got a few thoughts. As for when I saw this phenomenon emerge, so it definitely predates me, but I would say I dabbled with more progressive forms of Christianity when I was first becoming a Christian. But was eventually persuaded of biblical inspiration. So it wasn't long before I left it behind. You know, of course, we talked about definitions. Progressives tend to not like definitions very much. And it's partly because sometimes they hide behind them a little bit. We'll move on a little bit.
That's a really good point. That's important.
So what I will say as far as this kind of moment we're in now is that the internet allows for lots of small groups to grow and find new audiences. So we're seeing mainstream forms of progressive Christianity have a bit of a moment in recent years. I'll be interested in seeing where that goes. I think we're definitely in a period right now where we're very interested in kind of boutique identities, right? Where we sort of craft our own unique little identity. But I think we're also – that can be beneficial. Like, I love being part of this kind of LCI community and some libertarian Christians that I've met.
This is the only tribe you're allowed to be proud of.
Yeah. But that being said, I think at a certain point, people are going to want to be part of something that's a little bit broader and maybe even a little bit more grounded in history. So we'll see what happens. So as for what led to the movement, I would say history is more your area, Alex. So I'd be interested to hear how you'd answer that. But so my own kind of reading on it would be that, in short, it's generally thought to begun with the 18th to 19th century German theologian Friedrich Schleiermacher, who denied eternal life, saw Jesus as a mere man with a God consciousness, and argued that the existence of a personal God was not essential to Christian faith. In order to protect religious faith from rationalism and scientism, he placed it in the domain of personal feelings, such as natural human feelings of dependence. That sort of, when he talks about faith or that sort of sense of the numinous, he calls it natural human feelings of dependence. So basically the idea is, if we can kind of take faith and put it in this one little area of, you know, feelings or, you know, emotion or whatever, then it can't really be touched by science, and thus it can't be harmed by it. Of course, we have to, you know, shave off all the rough edges and get rid of all the things that make Christianity Christianity. But nevertheless, we can save it somehow. So I think liberal Christianity has tended to follow his example. It holds to kind of an unfalsifiable emotional core to Christianity and allows its doctrinal and historical claims to be trampled by modernistic anti-supernatural thinking. I don't think that its association with progressive political ideology was as apparent at the time, because Christianity in the 19th and early 20th centuries could be quite progressive politically, partly due to that sort of post-millennialist theological viewpoint, eschatological viewpoint. Though, of course, there are some culturally conservative tendencies that we see, such as the temperance movement. But basically, prior to the 1900s anyway, you really did have a Christianity in the West that was more politically activistic, even toward the left. And, you know, that's not the way it is now, but it was more the way it was then. Machen summarized the problem with liberalism, I think, pretty well when he wrote in Christianity and Liberalism. But if any one fact is clear on the basis of this evidence, it is that the Christian movement at its inception was not just a way of life in the modern sense, but a way of life founded upon a message. It was based not upon mere feeling, not upon a mere program of work, but upon an account of facts. In other words, it was based on doctrine. Christ died, that is history. Christ died for our sins, that is doctrine. Without these two elements joined in an absolutely indissoluble union, there is no Christianity. And I think he's right. And ultimately, what progressive Christianity does try to do is undermine the history, undermine the doctrine, and it's just kind of just this sort of feeling that we have.
Yeah, I definitely agree with a lot of that. And it definitely seems too, and I know we'll probably get into this once we start talking about the politics of progressive Christianity in the modern world, that you make the point that people are very susceptible to trends. And it seems like this has dramatically accelerated since 2016, when the media has been universally telling younger people that if they voted for Trump or support Trump or conservatism in any way, then they're a bad person. And I definitely think that that's pushing a lot of people into that camp, that desire for social acceptability. And in a lot of ways too, going back to the early 2000s, really the late 90s and early 2000s youth group culture, conservative youth group culture and evangelicalism, the whole point of that was to try to make church and Jesus seem appealing to young people. That was kind of the entire purpose of youth group, to make their faith, you know, relevant to the world. And so I think that there was a very shallow and facile version of Christianity that were presented to a lot of young evangelical kids. And then you combine that with these very conservative churches that did not allow these kids to ask difficult questions. And you were kind of creating this powder keg of, these kids know that it's a value to be relevant, and they also are frustrated that they can't ask a lot of questions. And then once they realized that what it meant to be relevant had moved on to being culturally and politically progressive, then they just moved right into that next camp, and they used all the anger that they had of not being able to ask those questions in their churches as a justification for their shift to the left. And I think a lot of people that have left the evangelical movement, they refer to this process as deconstruction, where they used to be very conservative and then they had to deconstruct their faith in some way and rebuild it back up. And I have a couple of questions about that for you guys. So what do you make of deconstruction, and is there anything positive about it? And then, of course, we know that there are like some very serious negatives that come along with deconstructing your faith. But what do you make of it? What are some of the positive and negative values that you might see in that process of deconstruction, if we can salvage anything from it at all?
Well, I guess I could start since Doug hasn't said anything yet. So with deconstruction, I would say the good part about deconstruction is that it's examining popular ideas to see if they hold up. The bad side is that it's open-ended, essentially. Some folks who were dead set against it sort of want to treat it as this movement toward atheism, which it isn't necessarily. But some of those who are kind of advocating for it are just sort of saying, well, all we're really doing is like getting rid of the really bad parts. And it's like, well, that's not necessarily true either. To deconstruct something just means you're taking it apart. So that's open-ended. So yeah. Without a standard to measure truth by, how can you tell if something is bad or wrong? If you don't have a measure of good and bad, how can you tell if you're moving in a better direction? And so ultimately, it's personal to every individual. They sort of decide what they want to hold on to and what they want to get rid of. And so the measure is essentially, once again, their own personal feelings. And ultimately, what I'd say is any movement that is open to atheism or heterodoxy isn't authentically Christian. You can't really call deconstruction a Christian movement in that sense. What it's essentially another way of kind of looking at it, or maybe another, I'll pull another term, semper reformanda, always reforming, which is sort of the clarion call of Protestantism, which is the host of the Protestant Libertarian podcast you could appreciate. Mm-hmm. Semper reformanda, I think, is better because it has a measure and it maintains a desire to authentically represent Christ as its goal. To always be reforming means that we're always trying to make the church better and we're always trying to make it more, more Christ-like or more biblical, if you like that, you like to use that word. So yes, I don't love deconstruction because it's open-ended. It could go any direction, and I don't think that's a great thing necessarily.
Yeah, what do you think, Doug?
Well, as I think I'm the oldest one in the room, but so I have more wisdom than the two of you. So I've seen it done better. No, I'm sort of jesting there. So one of the main, I would say one of the core missions of the seminary that I had gone to was sort of reaching out to, and not reaching out to, but ministering to and doing missional work. That was a big buzzword, kind of still is, to what was becoming a postmodern generation. And deconstruction was just sort of the, in the water, not only for the people we were trying to reach, but we were talking about it a lot as well. And I would probably say that I went through a phase of deconstruction and maybe in some ways still am in certain respects. And I think in always, if we're always reforming and, according to the likeness of Christ, then we're always deconstructing, reconstructing, deconstructing, it's that whole process. Right. And I think that can be a healthy way. What two types of deconstruction that I've noticed that I think are notable here. And one is, and I don't want to do a Mott and Bailey sort of like, well, all it really means is, I don't want to do that because that's kind of what the anti-racists do about being racist and all that kind of stuff. But there is a sense in which deconstruction is the sort of the philosophical method for making someone's faith their own. Instead of just merely accepting inherited traditions, dogmas, beliefs, practices, all of that, it's making it their own and asking the kinds of questions. Well, what about violence in the scripture in the Old Testament? What about seeing that, a God of the Old Testament that doesn't seem to resemble Jesus, or whatever you want to, that's a big objection over the last 20 years that's happened. Right. And the new atheist movement kind of brought that to the forefront, but whatever the questions that one has about the scriptures, sometimes it's a matter of, well, I want to understand this better because this doesn't sit right. And so Cody, you said something like, it's their own personal feeling, or it's open-ended in the sense that, like, well, they just get to determine, what it is that's right. And I think that can be correct. And, you and I were off air talking about some people that we believe are kind of doing that. But there are a lot of Christians who they look at the God revealed in Jesus and they say, some of these other things don't quite look like what this looks like. And if Jesus is the, you know, the ultimate representation of who God is, and, you know, there's several passages in scripture that point to that, Hebrews 1 being one of them, being kind of my go-to for that. And then, of course, you know, Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration, God says, you know, this is my son, listen to him. And so there is Jesus as God sort of puts a shade on some of the other things that people are reading. And so what they're doing is they're saying, well, how do I reread the scriptures in a way that makes sense of these things that don't sit right with me? And sometimes that means questioning, and even going against some of the, you know, long-held doctrines that are the non-liberal doctrines. I forget the ones you mentioned earlier, Cody, but in any case, I think there's a way in which deconstruction can be a valuable faith-growing opportunity to where someone has become more and more trusting of God, more so than just like, well, I just don't think this, you know, I just don't think this works out for me, and the Bible is just written by humans anyway, and, you know, all of that. There is a way to hold both of those things in tension. And so the hermeneutics of trust is one way to kind of think of this. That's a term that Norman Horn from, you know, you guys know him from LCI, he uses that a lot. The hermeneutics of trust versus the hermeneutics of suspicion or cynicism. And there are a lot of people who are on one side and a lot of people on the other. And the ones that are kind of annoy the three of us and all the people that we encounter in circles with are the ones that have this sort of hermeneutics of suspicion or cynicism. And it's just like, they're just peeved at whatever interpretation for, you know, both good or bad reasons. You know, I hear just to cite an example, because Preston Sprinkle is not completely affirming on the LGBT movement. When I say the word completely, I mean like what their perspective is, well, he doesn't accept gay people, then he's a terrible human being. And like, I've heard people say this and I was like, hold on. If you actually knew this person, you would not say this. But they know what he believes. He's not affirming. That's it. It's over. And so they're just like, that's a bad reason to reject somebody's political or theological position, is that you just don't like them. You just don't like, you know, their position. So I think deconstruction can go, you know, there are good things and bad things. I think the term gets a little bit of a bad rap because you have what is happening now in the political sphere and more of the cultural spheres. You have on college campuses, you see this in, you see the rise of the DEI movement, the woke movement, all of that is giving deconstruction a really bad rap because it does not necessarily mean destruction. If Marx gets a hold of the term deconstruction, it's going to become destruction. And what we have is an underlying Marxist tone in the way that we view society and the way that a lot of people view society. And so for them, deconstruction means let's just tear it all down or just tear down as much as we can. But this, because this doesn't make sense. I was lied to. I was, you know, abused by my pastor, my youth pastor. You know, take that word abuse and all the directions it can go, yeah. You know, right? And so they're hurt, and what are they going to do? They're going to lash back out. They're like, "This is all bad." And you know, again, I don't know everybody's story here, but I'm fortunate enough to not have that experience in conservative Christianity. I didn't see it happening in conservative Christianity that I was involved in. But we know it's in the news, and we know it's out there, and we know that this happens, and so. It's not surprising that people are going to react this way. And unfortunately, they were given basically two options. Well, you just trust God and do the right thing. Very, very agency oriented. Just choose the right thing, right? Or they had nowhere else to go. That they just had to leave. It was like that, take it or leave it. And they decided to leave it. But there are others who made space. I was talking about the emergent church. There were others who made space for the deconstructors. And some of those are actual genuine Christian communities that are in cities and in areas around the country and the world that are actually doing kingdom work. And some of them are, you know, doing weird leftist stuff that isn't quite kingdom work, but, you know, they are, I mean, To be fair, and to not give everybody, not to put everybody down in that movement at all, there are a lot of people who believe that it is their calling to love those on the margins the way Jesus did. And if that's what they're doing, as opposed to just active, you know, wanting Elon Musk to pay for it all, if that's what they're doing, then okay, good. you're mimicking Jesus, and I'm going to applaud that in particular. But anyway, I could keep going on and on. I think that's enough for that angle on it.
Yeah, I think you anticipated my next set of questions here really well, though. One of the points that you make is deconstruction has been embraced as a label by a lot of Christians that leave conservative evangelicalism. And one of the thoughts that I've had about that is that it's very, well, maybe not surprising is not the right word, but I find it very interesting that everyone that embraces the term deconstruction seems to move to the political left. Like, you don't have anyone that says, I deconstructed my faith and now I'm going to go vote for Trump and the MAGA agenda. You know, no one does that. So why is it that when people deconstruct, they tend to move to the political left? And then along with that, and this is kind of what you were getting at, what are some of the factors within conservative evangelicalism that might push those people out?
I can answer the first part, and it really has to do with the term deconstruct. Now, if you think about that, the word deconstruction means that there's something constructed that which can be deconstructed, right? So if you think about the moral institutions of the political right, they're rooted in order and structure. And so guess what? Institutions which provide structure and order are meant to be deconstructed if you're a deconstructionist, right? So they're meant to be torn down what is ordered or structured. So this I think explains why those on the right really regard deconstruction as a threat or maybe even a net bad. And when people say, well, oh, you don't want to go down there, or that's really threatening, I'm like, well, a threat to whom? You know, or it's bad for whom, right? And so I don't think it's a given that all institutions are good, and so deconstruction has its place. You know, that's part of the term deconstruction, is because in order to deconstruct something, you're going to attack that which is ordered and meant to provide structure. And that is the sort of moral intuition of the political right, including the Christian right. And so why leftward? Partly because it's just deconstructing power structures, and that's just a leftward phenomenon. And so you're already in the habit of the open-ended question of like, well, we're just going to question everything. And if you don't ever get to any sort of solid answers in some capacity, you're not going to want to reorder or restructure anything. And so that's what the left is all about at this point.
Yeah, I would just add about, you know, why does every kind of deconstructing Christian move to the political left? Or we'll say many. I could quote what Yuval Levin or Thomas Sowell or Arnold Kling, whom you recently had the opportunity to interview, Doug, have said about right versus left wing mindsets and thinking here. And it is useful, especially what Sowell says about progressives having an unconstrained view about human goodness and potential. But I think that the best explanation is probably sociological. It's about how humans come to hold propositions and believe them to be true. We tend to think that we are always sort of seeking the truth disinterestedly, but actually we don't pursue truth one piece at a time because it's inefficient. It takes forever. So instead we take a package of propositions together from like we're buying cable TV or something. We take a package of propositions together from our group or our tribe. And that's also beneficial for us because we succeed within groups, right? So if we believe all the things that our group believes, then we'll succeed within that group and we'll do well, right? And so I think, you know, that's ultimately how we tend to approach truth. We take a package. There's no particular reason of consistency why the majority of evangelicals in America should support war or immigration restriction or drug prohibition or even gun rights as a package deal. There's no reason why all those things should be put together with our Christianity. But we do it generally because we have given up on thoughtfully applying our faith to politics after the Republican Party invited us into their coalition and offered us protection and power on condition of us supporting their platform. So we gave into the group. And I think something similar happens with deconstruction. On the one hand, if you're leaving behind the religious part, the religious right package, you might as well think about leaving behind the right wing part while you're at it. On the other hand, to be secular is usually to be left wing politically. So as you find yourself more and more in that group, it's easier just to take on the whole package. We've been seeing sort of lately what happens to atheists who reject the progressive line, like Richard Dawkins and Robert Price, based on how they get treated when they do it. So I think it's that it's really a matter of groupthink. If you're getting rid of this thing and moving to this direction, you might as well sort of take on what everybody on the side is saying. Also, there could also just be a sense of just rejecting all the bad stuff, all that old stuff that I was part of that didn't work out for me must all be bad.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And this takes me to my next question. I've again made the argument before on this show, and I know that you guys have made this argument too, that there is a structural similarity, a very big structural similarity between progressive Christianity and Christian nationalism. And in a lot of ways, I think both of you kind of alluded to this in your answer to the last question. Progressive Christianity is just a mirror image in reverse of conservative evangelicalism. Like, structurally, it's very similar. They have their boundaries and they have their heresies, just like the conservative evangelicals do. And this is really kind of what I want to get to at the heart of this conversation. In what ways are Christian nationalists and progressive Christians similar? And I think to set this up, we all know that we're libertarians, and libertarians have a completely different conception of the left-right spectrum. It's not about, you know, progressive versus conservative. It's about the state versus freedom. That's the way that we conceptualize the political spectrum, which allows us to, I think, step outside of the way that people generally perceive that left-right binary and critique it for what it actually is. So I want to open this up to you guys too, with that caveat there in place. In what ways are the Christian nationalist and progressive Christians similar?
I'll just summarize it and then we can start talking about the particulars. But Carrie Baldwin, when we were at Freedom Fest back in 2022, she made this statement about basically that those on the left, I'll say it this way, conservatives want to politically enforce love the Lord your God, and the political left, the progressives, want to enforce love your neighbor as yourself. And both of them are wrongheaded. And if you think about the two sides of that coin, they're going to want to reflect, they want the nation's values to reflect those two things. And both of them are literally trying to make the nation Christ-like, which is kind of the idea of a Christian nation. Now, obviously, in the particulars, you ask any progressive, oh, they would just be like, oh, you just don't understand what we're trying to do. We're just trying to, you know, live in a pluralistic society, yada yada yada. You know, and we just speak truth to power, and you know, they come up with all their excuses. But you're right, Alex, and I've noted this for almost 20 years now to my leftist friends. This looks like you want the world, you want America to be a Christian nation. You just want it to be a Christian nation with tax, you know, that reflects a tax policy, or that reflects, you don't want people to have Christian values. You want the nation to enact things that you as a Christian think should happen. So anyway, those are my initial thoughts. I think Carrie Baldwin is like the best person that sums it up in that way. Like, love God, love your neighbor. Which side do you enforce politically? Well, the libertarian Christian would say, well, neither. That's the kingdom's work.
Yeah. I might just add, so in what ways are Christian nationalists and progressive Christians similar? There's kind of a horseshoe effect with radicals, right? So like on a political continuum, the far right and the far left kind of curve inward to meet each other. Mm-hmm. So despite all the differences between the extremes, they tend to share at least four things in common. One is a secular belief that it's the job of humans to fix the world through force, through legislation. They share an apocalyptic view of the world that if you don't vote for their politicians or support their policies, everything is going to hell in a handbasket. Thirdly, they have a strong belief in their own goodness. And fourthly, they have an unshakable belief that those who disagree with them are morons. So according to Olson, liberal theology has, quote, a tendency to reduce religion to ethics, especially social ethics, end quote. And man, if that ain't Christian nationalism. And the postmillennialism of so many theonomous Christian nationalists is really just a hair's breadth away from 19th century liberal Christianity. The main difference between the two is that Christian nationalists claim to have a high view of scripture, and many of them want to hang gay people. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I mean, it is very obvious. And again, once you step outside of that left-right binary, it's so obvious that structurally the progressive Christians and the Christian nationalists want the same thing. And that was one of the points that I noticed when I was reading Stephen Wolfe's book. For him, if you want to reduce his argument, you know, in his book, The Case for Christian Nationalism, to 3 points, it's number one, a Christian nation is a nation whose laws and customs reflect Christian values. Number two, these Christian laws and Christian values need to orient society society to the common good, both heavenly and earthly good. And then number three, that these have to be imposed at a national level. And this is exactly what the progressive Christians are advocating for. They have progressive Christian values, but they believe those progressive Christian values need to be enacted in law. They believe that they will bring good to the most number of people, and they believe they have to be enacted on the national level. And there's no difference between like those progressive Christians and someone like Stephen Wolf. And we've made Doug and Cody, you know, all three of us spent most of 2023 doing nothing but yelling at the Christian nationalists about this. So I don't want to beat a dead horse any more than we already have, because it's basically just a grease stain on the concrete now. But what makes Christian libertarianism a better worldview than either conservative or progressive Christianity?
Real quick, I was going to let Doug jump in, but I just kind of adding something to what you were talking about made me think of something, which is, you know, that they're, as far as they have a lot in common, but also just kind of what Doug was saying, that the, you know, the, how the right wants to sort of enforce love for God and the left wants to enforce love for neighbor. Another way to think about that is that the right basically sort of says, well, if we have a righteous order, and if we're ordered to the right things and we have the right values, then we'll also have a peaceful and just society. And the left sort of says, well, let's just make a peaceful and just society, and then who cares about a righteous order? And I think that you're right, Doug. They're just kind of starting from different places, but it does have to do with trying to kind of, from the top, make society into something. And then there's this belief that will create some kind of utopia. Then I was going to let you answer, Doug, the question about what makes Christian libertarianism a better holistic worldview.
Yeah, well, I hope you're using the word worldview a little bit more colloquially than sort of philosophically, because I'm not sure I would call it a worldview in that sort of way, because I'm a Christian first, libertarian second. But that's what I figured, and I don't want to perpetuate the idea that it's a worldview. But in any case, I think the biggest reason that a libertarian Christian mindset or view of politics is better is that it puts collective power in its place, or concentrated power in its place. It speaks truth to empire. It's the only political tradition, at least in the United States, that would carry on what the three of us, you know, have studied recently, the prophetic imagination, where we speak truth to empire. You don't see the left doing it. You don't see the right doing it. It also says that no person or institution or collective has claim over you or your personhood, or that which you own. And so there is a sense in which we call out to others, you don't have power over other people. So it's an equalizing way of looking at it, which is very Christian. I mean, I've often joked privately that, like, well, if America were like Libertopia, it would be a Christian nation. Because the Christian nation is to let people be left alone and for the kingdom to flourish. So, I mean, in that sense, in a very, very, you know, tongue-in-cheek sense, sure, I would like to be a Christian nationalist, but more of a, more in the sort of ironic way. That's going to be taken. That's going to be totally taken out of context.
I'm going to take a clip of that and put it on TikTok.
Yeah.
So I would say that I think that libertarianism gets us closer to the Christian ethic than either progressivism or conservatism. Christianity says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, which we call the golden rule. Libertarianism teaches the silver rule. Don't do to others what you don't want them to do to you. Christianity says, love your neighbor. Libertarianism says, well, at least don't hurt your neighbor. And so libertarianism doesn't require turning the other cheek or loving your neighbor, but it's at least not incompatible with it. It gets you halfway there.
Yeah.
In contrast, progressivism and conservatism go the opposite direction. They teach that we should initiate violent force against our neighbors to make them behave how we want them to, and to force our vision of the perfect society onto them. And ultimately, I would say these perspectives are evil, whereas libertarianism is the bare minimum ethic that we should expect from ourselves and others. So I tend to think of libertarianism as the ethic that Christians should at least want their non-Christian neighbors to hold to. Right. So, you know, maybe Christ wants more for us, but at least we should, you know, if we could kind of pick what our neighbors believed, if they're not going to be Christian, they should at least hope they'll be libertarian.
Yeah.
That's a really, I'm really glad you mentioned that, Cody, because that's actually one of the reasons that anytime I have this sort of individual impulse to be like, well, no, maybe we should just have this law that does this one little thing, or I want people to believe a certain way or whatever. And it's like, no, like I may want the nation to do that. Like, I may want tax policy to, you know, not tax policy, but just sort of like welfare policy to truly help the destitute. But like, it's not my job to decide what everybody else should want. And so it's what we should expect of our non-Christian neighbors, even if it's something that, you know, we may want to do, which is the, obviously that's the whole point of the idea of voluntarism and non-coercive, you know, action.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I love that. That's a fantastic answer there. And I think that is just it's just something that the average American that has never, it's like you said, Cody, the average American that's never really thought deeply about politics will just completely miss that point, because I think everyone just assumes that the purpose of politics is to inflict one's worldview upon other people, even if it's for, you know, supposedly benevolent reasons. And I think that leads us to the moment that we're in American society right now. So you had Trump get elected in 2016, and there was a massive, massive overreaction from the left. And I think we've been living through the consequences of that overreaction for the last 8 years. But as in all societies, when the pendulum swings too far to the left, eventually it's going to have to swing back to the right. And I worry just as much about that rightward swing as I am worried about the current leftward one. So what do we think about the future balance of power in American Christianity? So as the culture deals with these kind of broader culture wars that don't seem to have any sort of natural endpoint, does American Christianity go in a more progressive direction? Does it return to its conservative roots? Or, I mean, do most American Christians become libertarians? I would hope that would be the case, but that's probably not realistic. Or do people just abandon Christianity altogether? What do you guys see for the future of American Christianity?
Prognosticate, oh, great CEO of Libertarian Christian Institute.
Yeah. You think that's what I sit when I spend my time at my desk doing is prognosticating what's happening to Christianity. I'm pessimistic and optimistic. I know that's kind of a stupid answer, but I have a good amount of pessimism and despair over the current attack on Western values and the current attack on what we would call liberal values, because there are strange things afoot, right? I think that's quoting a Bill and Ted movie. There are strange things afoot, and there are strange things happening, and there are very dangerous ideas being promulgated in the name of justice. And those things, if you go back, if you take those away, it's going to be a very long time before we can get some of those back. And so I tend to have a very pessimistic view of the kinds of things that, because of the kinds of things that are happening in that space. There are little, you know, pinpricks of light in this dark box that we're seeing through right now. Or, you know, we can sort of see light at the end of a tunnel if maybe there's an end to the tunnel. I can mix up all kinds of metaphors later. But the optimism of me is that I know that the church does not depend on how the state of things in America, right? We might end up in a place where, sure, we might have the freedom to worship, but certain other things might have to be somewhat underground. That's not an inherently good or bad thing in terms of like spiritual health. It is better for things to be free and open, and you're allowed to say no to gay weddings if your church wants to do that, and you're not going to be, you know, there's not going to be ramifications politically. That is a better situation than in many respects. That would be that would be better in many respects than having to do everything underground the way the Chinese church or the North Korean churches had to do, right? So there's a lot going on, you know, there's a lot of options there on the table for what does the health of American Christianity look like? Maybe it doesn't look like power. Maybe it looks like you're somewhat oppressed, or you are oppressed, or you are having to be clever and nimble at how you do Christianity. Simply because you want to make an impact. So I'm optimistic on the one hand, pessimistic on the other. In terms of like a prognostication of like what might happen, I am pretty certain we're going to become more tribal before we become less tribal. It is such a deep psychological need to be tribal. And you're not going to override our human nature in a decade or even in 100 years where liberalism has actually, you know, taken hold, 200 years. You're not going to erase tens of thousands of human development in human habits in 200 years. You're just not. And we are going to become tribal. I am seeing it in myself as I evaluate what is currently going on in the Middle East. My little bit of tribalism is coming out in the way that I'm thinking about stuff. And I have to check myself and say, is this a thought or a claim based on some tribal thinking, or is this based on, you know, truth claims and certain, you know, moral principles that I hold to? And so we are going to see people become more tribal. And I think the only way that that's actually going to be okay and safe for American Christianity, or even just for people who believe in civilized society, is going to be if there is a sort of truce between the types of tribes that are battling. The truce would have to be, all right, we'll let you guys have your backward redneck church services if you let us have our pronouns or something. I don't know. I'm sort of making that particular, comparison up. But if we can live that way, that's a more libertarian take on things, right? That to me is the only way for us to survive a sort of civilizational clash, because the ideas of Western liberal democracy, and I don't mean the word democracy in the way that, Hoppe wants it right to mean, but I Western liberal power to the people kind of stuff is under threat. And yeah, well, I can keep rambling on. Cody, what is your stuff?
Yeah, I think it's hard to tell where American Christianity is going to be. I don't think Christian nationalism is going to take over. Stephen Wolfe's book, The Case for Christian Nationalism, suggests we go back to this sort of colonial America where someone like Increase Mather could argue with a straight face that we should keep the Baptist out of New England for the sake of cultural cohesion. And I don't think anybody's buying that dumb sack of garbage apart from emotionally insecure Presbyterians with big beards, literally and figuratively. So my main concern is not really Christian nationalism taking over. It's the damage it does to Christian teaching, faithfulness, and witness. I'm sure you guys have seen the story going around about Christian pastors being shamed by their congregants for preaching the Sermon on the Mount, and then being told that, now's not the time to follow Jesus because the transgenders are coming. And, traditionally, we've defined Christianity by a commitment to major theological creeds, which would, of course, put liberal Christianity or progressive Christianity on the outside of orthodoxy, the theological progressivism. But I think that all three of us, being influenced by Wesleyanism and Anabaptism to some extent as we are, would probably agree that it's also important to define Christians by our commitment to Christ and to living out his ethic. And when we do that, I think we could say that Christian nationalists are flirting with heresy, regardless of how many ecumenical and reformed creeds and confessions they put in their Twitter bios. So ultimately, I think liberal Christianity will, or progressive Christianity, if we're going to use Doug's term here, will still have some influence on the political left, but not that much. And I think Republican politicians will still try to rouse white evangelicals through appeals to this kind of Christian nationalism light to gain their votes. But I hope that God will stir both sides to serious commitment to not just believing the Bible, but also following it.
Yeah, I love it. Well, gentlemen, I got a couple more questions for you before I get you out of here tonight. I know I sent you these questions beforehand, but I'm going to flip the last two questions over because I think that makes sense considering what we just discussed. We're coming up on an election year, or I guess right now when I wrote this, I guess when I sent you guys these notes, it was in 2023. Now we are in 2024, so we are in an election year.
Alex, we've been in an election year for 3.5 years. Did
right,
you not know?
Yes. Well, and it's always the most important election of our lifetime. This is it. This one is the most important. And it will be, for the midterms in 2026.
This is like that verse in I forget the quote where like a day is like 1,000 years and 1,000 years as a day. Like when it comes to elections in the United States, like an election year is the whole 4 years. That's just it is what it is. Sorry, go ahead.
No, you're right. It never stops. So they're actually going to have the presidential election in 2024, despite what you might believe by watching the media. What will the narrative surrounding the election cycle that progressive Christians and Christian nationalists will use to justify their theological convictions? How is this election cycle going to work for those two groups?
I don't think it's going to be any different than we've already always heard. It's going to be the most important election of our lifetime. It's going to be politicians appealing to the values of whoever's in front of them. They're going to say things like Jesus is on my side and Jesus fed the poor. You know, Jesus, which is proof that he's not a socialist because he actually fed people. Yes. You know, they're gonna do that. They're gonna tell you how bad the other guy is, or how many times he mumbles every time he talks, and they're gonna talk about, you know, corruption. And you're going to see, you know, I go to the gym, and that's the only time I ever see anything on the news channels. And every single time, they're CNN on one TV and Fox on the next one right beside it. And I'm watching these for the last year, and it's literally CNN never says anything bad about Biden, and Fox News never says I shouldn't say never, but like almost never says anything bad about Trump. And it's always, you know, why the left ideals are a threat. And CNN is always talking about Trump's corruption and stuff like that. So we're just going to get the tribalism all over again. It's going to be, if it's going to be Trump and Biden, which it looks like it's going to be at this point, we're going to see roughly more of the same. You might actually see a little bit more of the tribalism heat up simply because the idea of a comeback is very potent in any situation, and in particular, even American politics. So for Trump to make a comeback, you're going to get some of the people who are like maybe holding their nose for Trump be like, nah, I'm going to be rooting for this guy. So that could be part of it as well.
Cody, what do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think Trump's made the left's job easy in that they don't really need a positive platform. All they have to do is talk about how evil Trump is and sloganize January 6th the way the neocons sloganized 9/11 in the 2000s. So, yeah, I mean, Christian nationalists are going to support or justify supporting a heathen pagan as their righteous prince, largely by claiming that Trump is a good cultural warrior. They'll blame Biden for the economic downturn that Trump started. And more legitimately, they'll point out that Trump actually did deliver some Supreme Court victories that no other Republican president has. Most of the stuff doesn't have anything to do with biblical theology, but we've sacralized politics and made it more important than the Bible. I guess you'd call that a sola culture war instead of sola scriptura as our primary source of authority. So, yeah, I mean, it's not going to be that different. I mean, obviously, we have the January 6th thing. We have the democracy is over thing, which they said last time, but they're really pushing it now because of the whole January 6th thing. So, you know, we're going to get a lot more of that.
Yeah. Great. Well, you know, it's always.
Sorry,
it's
Alex,
always.
I don't think you probably knew, though, that you didn't bring us on to make you feel happy about this year.
Yes, that's exactly. Well, I don't think there's any way to feel happy about this year. I mean, not that I'm that sad about it anyways. I am a libertarian, so I'm used to losing elections. I don't put my hope in elections anyways. And again, at the end of the day, if you don't like something that a politician tells you to do, you can just ignore them and do it anyways. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the libertarian position on a lot of these issues.
Move to Argentina, maybe.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Move to Argentina. Maybe we'll get some freedom there. Or at least there's no Federal Reserve. So that's always a good thing.
I knew there was a reason we sent our kids to Spanish immersion school.
Yeah. I mean, you guys were planning ahead.
I will be honest, that was not outside the list of 10 reasons why. It wouldn't be high on the list. I mean, there's obviously some more less far-fetched reasons, but the idea that, you know, if we needed to move south, really far south, we could do that.
Yeah, and now there's actually a place that you can go that's more free than the United States. So you got some options there. But with that, the last thing that I wanted to put to you guys here before we wrap up today is what are some ways that we as libertarians can engage with both progressive Christians and Christian nationalists that might help move them closer to the libertarian camp? I know that you and I, Cody, have, especially you, have tried to reach out to a lot of the big name Christian nationalists just to get them to talk, and none of them seem to want to have conversations with libertarians. I guess they don't like getting attacked from people that are also considered to be on the right or whatever. Yeah. But what are some ways that we can help those?
At the time, I wasn't even making fun of them publicly. Since they don't want to talk to me, I've decided I might as well. But at the time, I wasn't. I was being nice.
Yeah, nothing wrong with cyberbullying Christian nationalists.
I had I have a mutual friend. Oh no, wait! I went to college with him. He was at college at the same time I was, and he is kind of one of those like Doug Wilson fans and Christian nationalists or whatever. And I made a comment on something that he did on Facebook a few months ago, and there was someone else who it was about progress. Oh, it had to do with like the decadence and progress that we have in society now is just a bad thing. Like all the good things that we have in society from a sort of capitalism perspective is like just bad. And I was just like, wait, yeah. So it'd be nice if we just didn't, I made some snarky comment about like, yeah, it'd be nice if we just went back to, you know, living off the land and not, you know, having 10 kids just because the only three survive. And someone was like, they made this comment to me about progress, and I said something back. Oh, no, wait, they commented to me about the idea of progress or something. And then a few minutes later, replied to their own saying, never mind, I see you're a libertarian. And the guy wouldn't engage with me. It was absolutely that, oh, you're a libertarian. Like, yeah, the right doesn't like us either. And the left thinks we're on the right, which is crazy. Anyway, how can we encourage them? I'll give you my answer. We're not going to win them over by making fun of them online, Cody.
It is
that,
fun, though.
That is for sport. That is not for witnessing. Okay. And so if we want to do that, and I'll be, you know, I'm joking, obviously. And I think that has its place, because there will be people who see it and say, yeah, that actually is a nice critique, and to sort of mock a particular piece of something is actually good. I mean, memes have their value, right? And Cody, you're more than capable of providing a sharp critique in a way that other people can see as, you know, useful to them and their journey. So you're not going to convince the actual people convinced, or you're not going to unconvince them, I should say. But yeah, we reach out to people and have conversations personally, individually. It takes time. We're not going to get people to change their mind over who they're going to vote for this year, most likely. You might maybe get them to deprioritize the importance of what they're doing if you haven't had many conversations with them, but you are going to have to show them, especially those who are Christians, that the gospel does not depend on the state. And, you know, one thing that can be important for people who understand the importance of Christians being engaged in the public square, and I know that there's Anabaptists who don't believe that and so forth, but there is a witness to others in our world. And if there's any metaphor or any sort of thing to point out from the Gospels, it would be this, that all of the metaphors for the kingdom of God in the Gospels are nonviolent metaphors. They're all about the growing of the gospel is about growing. They're all agricultural. There's no take it by force sort of happenings in any metaphor when Jesus talked about the kingdom of God. And so if you need power, if you need force, if you need threat, if you need any of the things that we know the state does, that politics is made of, it's not kingdom. And so anyway, if there's a Christian message, if there's a gospel message in there, that's that for them. But from a practical standpoint, we're not going to convince them this year for this election.
Yeah, I'll just, Doug, what you said about, yeah, making fun. I tend to think of sarcasm as a spiritual gift for me, but I've also seen it not be so effective. And you know, I think there, one thing we do have to do, sometimes maybe making fun a little bit can be helpful, but I do think we have to humanize. And, you know, some libertarians kind of live in silos by themselves and just kind of throw rocks at everybody. But I think for the most part, you know, we kind of have this kind of balance that we can do where we can sort of say, you know, my progressive and conservative neighbors believe in using violence against me when I'm a peaceful person. Nevertheless, I'm not going to not be friends with them. They're still like my friends, they're still my neighbors, they're still my family. And I think we can walk that line in a way that weirdly Republicans and Democrats can't. Like, you know, there's a hair's breadth, essentially, you know, they disagree on what to use the violence for, but they agree on the violence. And so it's like you'd think that there'd be a little bit of, you know, respect among, you know, thieves or whatever, but there's not. And but I think, you know, generally speaking, we can walk that a little bit. But I will say, yes, we want to avoid dehumanizing, even if, you know, occasionally we want to poke fun at maybe what seems like a dumb idea or an inconsistency. So as for bringing Christians closer to the libertarian camp, so if we're just talking about kind of leaving the politics out of it, I guess. And maybe appealing to Christians who are maybe conservative theologically. I was interviewed a few years ago on Derek Kreider's Fourth Way podcast about holding to Christian anarchism as a theological conservative. And I pointed out there that we have to be willing to make a biblical case for Christian anarchism or Christian libertarianism without flinching or softening our view of inspiration. I think far too often what you see is people sort of go on this path toward Christian anarchy or whatever, they loosen, they soften their view of inspiration. And what that communicates to people who believe the Bible is, well, there must not be anything here for me. If you have to lose your belief and inspiration to become a Christian anarchist, then I guess there's no reason for me to look into it. And I think what we need to be able to do is say, I believe the Bible, and I don't think that the Bible supports statism. When it comes to persuading people on the political left and right, I think you need to address what their reservations are about freedom. You have to look at those areas where they say, okay, freedom is great for some issues, but when it comes to X, we have to have a centralized authority in place to build a good and just world. And so then I think you can address how that need would be better satisfied with freedom, or explain how coercion creates even worse problems. But maybe even before you do that, I think creating a foundation of voluntarism, because I think instinctively we get voluntarism or voluntarism. It always bothers me that why. But we get it because it's like we apply that in every other area of our lives, and we have this one little exception we cut out for politics. And, you know, we sort of understand when it's violence that we don't like, you know, like sodomy laws if you're on the left, or gun laws if you're on the right or whatever. We get when it's oppressive in a way we don't like it. We think it's bad and horrible. But we carve out these little exceptions for ourselves. And I think ultimately what it is just kind of pushing that voluntarism toward the edges and saying, okay, well, you agree with me on 99% of these things. How can we get rid of this one last 1% where you think we can bend the rules and do things that under other circumstances we would call evil?
Yeah, I really appreciate that. Man, you guys have been awesome tonight. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about this. Again, it is like almost my bedtime. I go to bed very early at like 9:30, and you two are some of the only people that I would ever stay up this late to talk with. So you guys should feel very special and important because of that. So before I let you guys go, you guys have been great. I wanted to give both you guys a chance to plug your shows, where people can find you and find your work.
You can find me on libertarianchristians.com. You can go to the contact page there. I'm on Twitter, not really. I mean, I browse Twitter. I don't really post on Twitter except through LCI sometimes. So, yeah, the best place to find me would be libertarianchristians.com.
Yeah, Libertarian Christian Institute is also charitable enough to publish my stuff sometimes. So if you search me there, you can find my stuff there. I also have a website address that's impossible to remember. It's cantusfirmus.com, cantus-firmus, cantus-firmus.com. There you can find blog entries, podcasts, social media stuff, YouTube, TikTok, whatever, videos. And that's about it. Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, thank you guys for coming on the show tonight.
Thank Great you, to be here. It was a fun conversation.
So thank you, Doug. Thank you, Ox. And I'll see you at the champagne room, the VIP after party.
Sounds great. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Protestant Libertarian Podcast. If you have any questions or comments, please reach out to me at theprotestantlibertarian@gmail.com. You can also find me on Twitter. You can follow me at the handle @ProLibertyPod. Again, that is @ProLibertyPod. And you can also visit me at theprotestantlibertarianpodcast.com. At theprotestantlibertarianpodcast.com, you can also support the Christians for Liberty Network and the Libertarian Christian Institute. Thank you guys so much for listening to this episode, and we will see you next Tuesday.